Well, so far, so good. It's a great day. It's a special occasion for Martin and Anne and Neil and Claire. I write it down, Mike. Where are you? I write the names down. It's a whole lot easier than trying to remember them.
I write them down wrong.
It's also a special day for us as a church, in fact. Because, you know, people coming to faith, people being baptized, it's just the essence, isn't it, of what we are as a church, what we seek to be as a church. And as excited as you guys are, believe me, we are excited as well. It's great to welcome family and friends and probably some other people as well. And the danger of today, of course, is that if you're a strange face, and you know what I mean by that, that we assume you're with these families, and please forgive us if you escape without us saying hello to you as being new here. Hopefully that won't happen, but if you're here just by accident today, well, the Lord bless you, and hopefully we'll get to know you as well. So by now, then, you're either thinking, oh, this is great, I'll come here again, or you're thinking, whoa, this is weird. Where's the exit? Well, if you think it's weird so far, just wait a bit longer, right? Because you're going to see four fully grown human beings voluntarily walk into this pool and be plunged underwater. Oh, and brought back up again as well. So why? You know, what are they doing? Mike's already explained what baptism's all about. I found this quote from a guy called John Piper, who's a US-American pastor. It's quite a long quote. He says, "These people being baptized are unashamedly declaring that Jesus Christ has won their heart and that they've given over control of their lives to him. They're saying that alongside other Christians in the church, from this day forward, for better or for worse, for rich, oh no, it's the wrong service, isn't it? For this day forward and for the rest of their lives, with the help of the Holy Spirit, they're going to follow Jesus, to serve him, to speak up for him, and to bear witness to him." Now you're either thinking, wow, that's so inspiring. Or you're thinking, that's really weird. These guys are joining some sort of mind-controlled sect or something like that. Rather than inspiring, you may be thinking, their lives are over. What are they doing? Well, let's face it, churches are famous, aren't they, for this sort of impression of being, you know, come to church, turn up, stand up, sing up, shut up, and cough up. Because churches are all about money, aren't they? It's all about asking for money in church. Surely these Christianity, there's too many rules. There's too many thou shalt nots. They're against everything, these Christians. They're killjoys, miserable so-and-sos. Isn't that the way we're often depicted out there in the big wide world? Mary had a little lamb, 'twas given her to keep. But then she joined the local church and died from lack of sleep. Actually, it's a bit close to home, that, isn't it? Isn't it? Yeah. Well, is there any truth in any of this? Well, there's some, I guess. God did give some commandments to his people. 10 of them. Some of them are okay, actually. Some of them are thou shalt not, it has to be said. Designed to help people live well together in peace and harmony. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not lie. Thou shalt not covet. These are broad principles. God has given his people broad principles within which you can enjoy life to the full. That's why Jesus came. It's like being on the motorway of the Christian life. headed in the direction of God himself and his heaven, the place where one day you'll spend eternity with him forever. There are some barriers. I missed a bit out. Headed in the direction of God himself. We're in different cars. We're going at different speeds. We're in different lanes, and it's okay to change lanes. Different styles of driving, you've probably noticed on the motorway. Nobody as good as yourself, obviously. There are some barriers to keep you safe, to stop you going off into bad ground, to stop you actually joining the people going in the wrong direction as well. But within those barriers, those guidelines for Christian life, you can enjoy the journey to your heart's content with the Lord within you. So to help us think briefly about this, a couple of incidents from Jesus' life. Now, we've been looking as a church at Mark's Gospel, story of Jesus in Mark's Gospel. And I did think this morning, should I think about something else, preach about something else, but actually, I think we can draw something from this passage, a couple of incidents here from Jesus' life. The first one is that Jesus is questioned about fasting. So once again, I've started at the wrong place. Now, John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. That's John the Baptist and the Pharisees were fasting. Some people came and asked Jesus, how is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours are not? And Jesus answered, how can the guests of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? They cannot, so long as they have him with them. But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, and on that day they will fast. Now, fasting is the practice of missing meals and combining that with earnest prayer for something. Fasting both sharpens the mind, because you haven't got all that stuff within you, sort of slowing you down, but also shows how serious you are to God about praying for something. In the Old Testament, God commanded people to fast, his people to fast, once a year, on one day of the year, to focus on him. It was called the Day of Atonement, the day when you focused on him and you were put right with God. As history developed for the Jewish nation, they picked four special days when significant things had happened in the life of the history of the Jewish nation. And on those days, they encouraged people to fast 4 days. Now, these Pharisees that we read about here, these are people who were really keen in their faith. And they developed loads of rules and regulations to show how keen they were in their faith. You read from the books here that probably most of them will have fasted not once a year, not 4 times a year, but twice a week. They took it seriously. They put ash on their faces to make themselves look pale so that people knew they were fasting and didn't have, a square meal within them. That's the point. Everyone knew that they were fasting. Look at us. We're proper holy in it. Bit of culture there for you. So that was the Pharisees. Now, John the Baptist's disciples, we don't really know too much about. Maybe he was in prison at this time. Maybe they were praying and fasting that he would be released from prison. Maybe it's just because John the Baptist's message was one of repentance, and they were perhaps fasting, centering on that theme. Well, we don't know. Either way, these groups were fasting, but Jesus' disciples weren't. And the people ask, why? And Jesus paints this picture of the wedding celebrations. More likely, actually, the stag do. Now, stop thinking immediately about modern day stag weekends or even weeks, I think, nowadays, isn't it? In these days, it was simply time together for the groom and his male friends to enjoy each other's company before the groom was married, was taken away from them, as it were, so that he could give attention to his bride. And this time together with his mates included food and laughter and good times. It wasn't a time for fasting. And Jesus is saying, that time will come. I'm not saying fasting's wrong, that time will come, but not now. And so what Jesus is saying is that If you like, he's the bridegroom, and the disciples are his guests. And while he's with them, before he's taken from them, it's about rejoicing and not refraining. See, the Christian life is about enjoying life. It's about making the most of life. It's about living it to the full, but within those reasonable safety barriers. Rejoicing, not refraining. Second incident, or in fact the second and third incident, concern what Jesus was doing on the Sabbath. Now the Sabbath was the one day a week that God had set aside to be kept holy. So no work, instead rest, and a day therefore set aside to worship God. So for them it was the Saturday. For us it's become Sunday. Let's read this first incident then. One Sabbath Jesus was going through the grain fields, and as his disciples walked along, they began to pick some of the heads of grain. The Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" He answered, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need? In the days of Abiathar the high priest, he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful only for priests to eat. And he also gave some to his companions. Then he said to them, 'The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath.'" So it centers around these Pharisees again. And to show how serious they were about their faith, they'd come up with something just short of 400 do's and don'ts for proper Sabbath day keeping. You could understand it in a way, because people wanted to know what they could get away with and still keep the Sabbath holy. Is it okay to go for a stroll on a Sabbath? They might have asked. Well, yes, but not too fast, because there's too much purpose in that, and that's the focus then of what you're doing. And not too far, because that's too much like hard work. And certainly don't carry anything, don't take something for someone else because you're going past their front door, because that's work. Do you see? It's work, and you're not allowed to do that. That's just an example. And certainly harvesting was not allowed. Harvesting was work. It's obvious, therefore you can't do it. But how about just strolling through the fields and plucking a few grains of corn? Doesn't say they were eating them. They might have been throwing them at each other. Don't know, do we? Well, according to the Pharisees, it mattered. For this reason, no ear picking was allowed. I've just read that again and think, ew. If somebody just come in now, or some alien just landed or something, no ear picking allowed. These Christians really are weird, aren't they? So the Pharisees spot Jesus and his disciples and point out the error of his ways. Tut tut, Jesus. But Jesus reminds them of an Old Testament story. You'll find it in the Bible, 1 Samuel chapter 21, verses 1 to 6. One of the Bible's heroes, King David, with his friends, companions, hungry and needy, entered the temple and ate the consecrated bread. Bread that would have been prayed over and kept for special holy days that would have been perhaps distributed to the people at some point, but not, you don't take it, you're giving it. It's strictly, therefore, a no-no to go and take this bread. But you see, David was an exception, wasn't he? He was one of God's chosen people. He was the king, and he was in need. And so the bread was available, therefore go for it. In other words, Jesus is saying you need a proper perspective on these things. And in this situation, plucking a few grains of corn as you stroll through the wheat fields you know, the perspective on that is that, you know, why not? Sabbath is to be enjoyed, not endured. Or as Jesus said in verse 27, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Now clearly the Pharisees weren't listening, because then it moves on to another time. Chapter 3, another time Jesus went into the synagogue, so this would be on the Sabbath, obviously, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" But they remained silent. He looked around at them in anger, and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. And the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. Well, by now the Pharisees have begun to dislike Jesus. He's threatening their way of doing things. People were following him rather than following them. So they're looking to discredit him. They're looking for a reason to accuse him. So they're all gathered at the synagogue. Now, did you hear the irony in what we read? They watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. Irony time. They recognized him as someone who could heal. Who might Jesus be then? Someone who could heal. Oh, maybe the Son of God. Maybe the Messiah. Maybe the Holy One of God that the nation of Israel had been waiting for forever. But blind to that possibility, because they're trying to trip him up, they're looking to catch him healing on the Sabbath. Crazy. Although there's a logic, isn't there? I suppose if your work consists of healing, that's what you do for a living, and you heal on a Sunday, then you're working, aren't you? Gotcha. But Jesus knew how to handle them. You know, he said to them, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? But they remained silent. There's no answer. They couldn't answer him, could they? Because they knew they were walking into his trap this time. So Jesus heals the man. And the Pharisees leave and begin to plot with the Herodians. Quite significant, because the Pharisees and the Herodians were implacable enemies. Not that they sort of fought each other, but their theology was so different that they would never speak to each other. But now, let's get together with those enemies of ours and see if we can sort out the big enemy, Jesus. See, the problem was the Pharisees really wanted to show God how much they believed, but their rules and regulations blinded them to the simple things that God wanted. And I'm afraid to say, they were just paying lip service to their faith. And what Jesus is showing by healing this man is that the Christian life is about love and not lip service. It's about rejoicing and not refraining. As Jesus said, you know, the law can be summed up in these things. Two things. Love God and love your neighbour as yourself. It's as simple as that. And so the challenge of Jesus to his generation, and to every generation, and to us at Saltersford Church, you know, is quite simple in a way. To you guys who are being baptised, quite simple in a way. Because the tendency is for every generation of believers to shape their faith and to do church the way that we like it. And our traditions that have worked for a while and have been really good become rules. One way of doing things becomes the only way of doing things. And Jesus is saying, yeah, it's not like that. I don't think I put this on the screen, actually, so I forgot. But we've missed out a few verses in between. Jesus said this, "No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the new piece will pull away from the old, making the tear worse." Nightmare for a Scouser. Making the tear worse. "And no one pours new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and both the wine and the wineskins will be ruined. No, he pours new wine into new wineskins." Bit of a cryptic crossword clue that, isn't it? He's saying, look, Jesus is the new unshrunk cloth who's come to the old clothes of the Jewish faith, if you like. You know, you can't just patch up the old Jewish faith with this new cloth. Because when you wash it, the new cloth will shrink, you know, and it'll pull apart the old clothes. He's saying Jesus is the new wine. I am the new wine, he's saying. Do you know, you can't... The new wine needs to... What does it need to do? That stuff it does when you make wine.
Ferment.
Thank you. It needs to ferment. Old wineskins, they dry and crack. They've already expanded and stretched to take the previous lot of fermented wine. If you put new wine in old wineskins, it'll burst. You need new wineskins. You see what he's saying? That old Jewish faith is cracked. It needs to be renewed. You see what he's saying? The way we've always done church, you know, has got its flaws. And Jesus comes to every generation and says, find ways in which the new thing that he's doing will fit in the structure of your church. The Pharisees needed to learn that. We need to hold on to that. Jesus and his message needs to be shown and made relevant in every generation. Because the message is the same. The message never changes. The Christian life, it's about rejoicing, not refraining. It's about love, not lip service. It's about loving God and loving your neighbour. So Martin and Anne and Neil and Claire, you're not losing your life today. You're not throwing your life away today. You're gaining your life. One or two of you have mentioned that in your testimonies today. Following Christ means you'll live your life as it was meant to be, as you were created to be. You'll be doing what you were created for. You'll be loving God and loving your neighbour. So enjoy the rest of your lives, starting in just a moment.